Can I also direct your kind of attention to the issue about your positioning in that exchange that you had with the producers, and your construction as a kind of an ethnic or a Leb or Arab writer or a Western suburbs writer? And I'm wondering, there's a double barrel question here. Do you feel that as a burden? And secondly, I'm really interested to kind of continue the discussion that we've had on several occasions, why you take your inspiration from James Joyce and not David Malouf. So, sorry to put them together,
no,
but
that
kind
of go. Is that okay? Firstly, in terms of burden of representation, I understand burden of representation in two ways. There's the burden you feel as an artist making work, and then there's the burden of representation as an individual within society. So I mainly experience burden of representation as a human being operating in a nation state, living within a national identity. And so a good example is that whenever I worked with the white left artists as a young man, I would find that they were very comfortable writing up, for example, in their creative development, something like the Prophet Muhammad is, and I don't want to say the rest, and say, we're artists, we're just experimenting and we're just exploring ideas. This isn't our attitude towards you. Whereas if I, in my development, in my creative work, was saying the word slut, then I wasn't an artist. I was a misogynistic Arab Muslim male who hated women. And this is the way I understood my burden of representation, is that I was constructed in those spaces as a one-dimensional human being, whereas the artists I worked with often saw themselves as three-dimensional, not just the racial identity, but the artist identity, the gendered identity, the sexuality identity, the class identity, and they were constantly moving in and out of those spaces. But in literature, my argument is, and I'm spending a lot of time fighting with my writers, the young writers that I work with about this, I don't see it as actually a burden of representation to write about your identity. I see it as a form of empowerment, because I look at the cultural theory of bell hooks, an important African-American social activist who talks about the act of coming to voice, which is moving from silence to speech as a revolutionary gesture. And when I meet young writers who are telling me that they don't want to write the ethnic story, I ask them, what do you want to write as an alternative to that? And they'll say, I just want to be universal like any other person. But when you look at what they've written, it's just a reinforcement of white power structures. It's just rehashing what middle-class white American kids are writing in relation to vampires. So I don't think you can actually escape the burden of representation in writing. I think you can either represent, you can choose actively to represent yourself, or you can do someone a favor and represent them, or hurt them by representing, which is a different discussion.
Do you want to respond to the Malouf question?
Sorry. By the way, I'm sorry. I'm seeming like I'm getting really angry, but it's just the way we do it in my household.
I think. I mean, one of the interesting things about working on identity is that the moment you start mentioning it and talking about it, you're doing it violence. Because identity is always far more complex than the way you talk about it. Because language, by its very nature, fixes. And language just pins you down. And identity is not just the question as sort of like, which is true, that it's fluid and all this, but it's actually a continuous oscillation. It's not just the question of do I feel Lebanese or do I feel universal? The thing is, I'm constantly oscillating between the two. I'm constantly oscillating between being a Lebanese, Lebanese being a Lebanese universal, and being Australian and being an Australian universal. I can keep on sort of like adding how many things one is oscillating about, you know, but And the fact is, what is always damaging is when somebody tries to fix your oscillation. And that is really what racism is always about. It's not about making you Lebanese when you want to be universal, or making you, because a lot of racism involves making you universal when you want to be a Lebanese. You know, over the years, I've always had this thing. I've worked with often middle class, or at least students with a lot of cultural capital, but who have an ethnic background, and who have a kind of like critical outlook by the time their PhD is. And so they treat this idea that, you know, somebody asks them at a party, it becomes a cliche, where do you come from, you know. So, and so they actually, a lot of my students have it as a cliche themselves. They say, I got the where you come from treatment yesterday. So that's how they talk about it. And the where you come from is sort of like the idea that me as a student, I'm a universal. And somebody comes and pins me down to being, where are you from? Plus there's the issue of somebody thinks they're in power to ask you and all of this. But one of the interesting things is when I was doing field work with working class, not just Lebanese, actually, at some in some place, but anyway, but it was a Lebanese person who said to me, and that was so sort of interesting to me because it was word for word almost. He said to me, you know, I've been working in this office for a whole month, and nobody has asked me anything about my Lebaneseness. And I thought, now, here's this guy is actually not happy because nobody is asking, is actually taken. And so, in a way, it's just makes you understand white people. I mean, sort of like sometimes, so what do you want? You know, it's sort of like blah, 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 that doesn't work. What do you like, after all? But precisely what I like is the fact that, I mean, this morning I might wake up and feel like a Manouche, and I'll feel 100% Lebanese, but maybe in a split second I'll also feel 100% Australian. And as I'm driving here, I'm feeling Lebanese and Australian and universal and a billion other things that are related to gender and sexuality and classes and everything. And some petty thing wants to pin this richness into, fix it into, you are this. Yeah. That's racism to me. It's not, that's that moment of being fixed, whether it's your grandmother who's fixing you, whether your ethnic leader is fixing you, or whether it's some white racist is fixing you. All of them are contributing in creating racialized identities.
Can I ask you to elaborate that? Because it's not just about an interpersonal exchange that happens there, it's a politics. And so what you're saying there echoes for me the interest that you've had recently in kind of arguments about multiple realities. And you ask that question, what kind of imaginary inspires radical politics today? So we can sit here and whinge about the bad things, but what is it that inspires people to do a radical politics that might confront, challenge and change those things?
Yes, well, to me, this takes a slightly different edge because what I'm exploring in that notion of multiple realities is another complexity, which starting point is actually where you and I started, which is in Marxist circles at university, where the critical question was always to unearth the relation of power. Relations of power are always hidden, and the analytic work is always about find the patriarchal relation of power, find the class relation of power, find that relation of power. unearth it and show how it structures reality. Now, when you do this, it's very interesting because you approach things with the idea that you are uncovering what's hidden. And I still am totally for that exercise, that analytic exercise of uncovering relations of power. But what struck me was because you posit the relation as hidden, and because it is, and you go for it and uncover it, then you think that's all there is. I've uncovered the relation of power, and I stop. I say, I've done my work. See, there's a relation of power. And my multiple reality question was, well, okay, maybe there's another relation. What of other relations, which were not relations of power? Shouldn't we be looking at them? I just give very quickly an example. So I was in London chairing a conversation between this Israeli and Palestinian activists. And they were at each other's throat, and I could see all the arguments all my life I've seen. And I can see lots of viciousness to begin with. And I could see the relation of power between Israeli colonialists and Palestinians being reflected in that conversation. But then I started noticing something which I don't know if others noticed it at the time, but I had a very distinct feeling about an hour through the conversation. I honestly tell you I had that feeling that they had the hots for each other. It just struck me as I was sort of like sitting. I think,
who was it?
And it's not a secret anymore, but they overseas.
Oh, yeah.
But they were just like, there was some gaze that was happening. And so we had the coffee break. And sure enough, they started chatting. And we came back. Now that's what that moment was interesting for me, because they were totally unrepentant and they went back into absolutely trying to slaughter each other in that. But there was another relation. So that to me is the alter moment. So the alter moment, which is not the anti moment, that interests me. So that you can engage in anti politics, but you have to be able to think that there are other. So it's not the question that the love is the solution. That's too simplistic. It's just that the love opens another space where it could be a solution, it could be worse, it could be furthering the colonial relation. It does, but it is another space where something else is played other than just relations of power.
Can I bring Muhammad in here? Because at one level I would argue that fiction can capture that much better than academic writing, that kind of multiplicity of perspectives and possibilities and intentions and so on. You know, we had that tradition of the modernist writers who kind of play with perspective and so on, and that tradition of imagining other things. So there's that kind of question about the role of literature there, but also want to kind of link that to the question of radical literature, which is the theme of today. And because if Ghassan asks what kind of imaginary inspires radical politics, can we ask the same kind of question of radical literature? I mean, do you see your writing as radical, and is there a kind of a vision which grapples with those kinds of questions that Ghassan is
Can I, just before I answer, can I know the time, just so...
This is the last question.
Last question, and then...
I'm in control.
Okay.
I've got...
Yep.
I'm managing.
It's also so that...
Answer the question.
Okay. It's also so that I'm in control of how long I go for, but... you know, the privileged position of a university is that we fast track to literature. So we go from high school in whatever capacity you came out of that space, and for whatever reasons you came out of that space and went into a university setting, assuming that you are literate and that you're ready for literature. And so My work and my understanding of this question actually becomes more about literacy before literature, that literacy is a radical political act. And when I say this, I mean it in the kind of broadest, most complex way we can engage in literacy. So I'm not talking about the ability to put together letters and the ability for letters to make words and words to make sentences and sentences to make paragraphs. What I mean by literacy is a critical consciousness, the ability to read, write, think critically about what you're seeing, deconstruct and respond. And if you look again at the work of bell hooks, she talks extensively about how degrees of literacy determine how we see what we see. And so any move towards freedom and justice in any culture is dependent on a mass-based literacy movement. Now, bell hooks uses the example of Malcolm X, who's a big attribute of my doctoral studies and my own creative writing. But I actually use a much more controversial but much more potent example, which is the story of the Prophet Muhammad. Because even though, not everybody on earth is a Muslim, I would argue that everybody on earth since the birth of Islam has been affected by Islam one way or another. And the origin story of the Prophet Muhammad's revelations, regardless of whether you believe them as fiction or whether you believe them as divine revelation, is the story of literacy, that Muhammad was illiterate and the angel Jibril in Arabic appeared before him and said, "Iqra bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq, khalaqa al-insana min 'alaq, iqra wa rabbuka al-akram alladhi 'allama bil-qalam, 'allama al-insana ma lam ya'lam," which translates in English as closely as possible to "Read in the name of thy Lord who created humankind from a clinging clot. Read, for your Lord is most bountiful, who taught humankind by means of the pen, taught humankind that which they do not know." And the idea of the narrative of the Prophet Muhammad is that he was illiterate and God gave him the power to be a master of letters, to recite the revelations of the Quran. And so this speaks about, to me, the historical power that we give literacy and that we understand literacy, that it has the same abilities to transform as splitting the Red Sea or being resurrected from the dead. And so to be literate is a dangerous position to come from.
Did you actually just translate this now as you're talking?
I'll just answer.
I've heard this story before.
Oh, yeah, of course. Okay, of course, so hopefully. But I will say this one thing. I didn't translate it, but I am very conscientious of particular translations which are limited. And so in many cases, God is referred to as he, and humankind is referred to as mankind in the translations, which I, as a creative writer and as a critical thinker, don't appreciate. So I have my own interpretation.
More commenting. I thought if you had just translated that first bit as you were talking now, I thought, wow.
Not that good.
Well, I don't think he answered my question, but that's by the way. I got through about a third of my questions, but I would like to open it up now to questions from the floor, if people would like
to. So if people have questions for me, please note that I'm hearing impaired, and just don't shout, just speak a little bit slowly and clearly.
Like me.
You shout.
I shout, yeah. Don't shout.
Okay, any questions, please? I've got a whole stack here that I'm prepared to go back into. Yes.
I'd love to hear your response to the Maloof question.
Thank you.
Okay. There were two kind of separate. It was one question, but the answers for me are separate. So there was a question on James Joyce, and there was a question on David Maloof. To answer our firstly about Joyce, The specific story that was part of my research for my honours thesis, which was a creative and exegetical component, was to look at James Joyce's The Dead, which is the last short story in Dubliners. And the reason I was looking at it is because Joyce has the capacity to manage large groups of characters and within the setting of a house, which becomes some kind of symbolic community and national presence. And so this was really what I was dealing with in the last, particularly the last short story in The Tribe. But the most miraculous thing, my discovery through my research, is that Joyce's story, The Dead, is about the living dead. It's about, it's a commentary on this soul, this culture that is decaying. And by contrast, what happens in The Tribe is the grandmother dies and the tribe come to life. They all just become super and hyperhuman. And so I was actually interested not just in Joyce's influence on my work, but how a contemporary Arab, Australian, Muslim, Alawite, Western Sydney interpretation of Joyce's work looks at a transformative attribute or aspect or a paralleling or opposite aspect to the work. Now, with regards to David Maloof, you know, if you look at the first story in The Tribe, it is actually very heavily influenced by the work of David Maloof, 12 Edmundston Street, which also is kind of a surveying of the household. But with all due respect, because, of course, David Maloof is an important Australian writer and he's brought up extensively being from Lebanese background. In fact, I picked it up in Kids, Kebabs, Cops and Crime yesterday as a prominent Lebanese figure. But actually, David Maloof's Lebanese origins don't come up very often, if ever, in his work. And in often he's referring to the motherland, this ambiguous place, when he's talking about his identity outside of Australia. And as a way, I guess, of compensating for this, there's a real heavy emphasis on nature as a way of perhaps saying, we all come from the ground. It doesn't matter where we're from. So I take a little bit of a distaste. I can't really comprehend it because my work brings out the Arab-Australian-ness, the Lebanese identity on the first page. It's all that I care about. And my theory now is that, you know, David Maloof comes from a post-World War II generation looking towards Europe, and I come from a post-9/11.
It's actually very common in it's very common in that wave of Maronite, Christian, Lebanese migration not to be that hung up on where you come from.
Yeah.
So it's not specific to Australia.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And so my position on this is that coming from a post-9/11 Arab-Australian Muslim Western Sydney context is that we were looking towards the United States, really, towards African-American subaltern hype in popular culture. So I've been looking closely at black autobiographical fiction as an influence as opposed to David Maloof.
Okay. Another question? Yep.
I was wondering what your stance is on how useful multiculturalism is today.
Sorry, I didn't hear.
How useful do you think multiculturalism is today, especially in metropolitan Sydney and Melbourne?
So, I mean, one of the things, I'm sorry, I have to sort of like put quite a few introductions before replying to your question. Often people sort of like read White Nation and say it's a critique of multiculturalism. Now, I never wrote a critique of multiculturalism. In fact, I don't know what multiculturalism means. To me, there are multiple experiences of multiculturalism. You have a government mode of experiencing multiculturalism. You have a white mode of experiencing multiculturalism, which is what I concentrated on in White Nation. You have a variety of ethnic ways of... In fact, I put a lot of effort in saying what I examined was a white experience of multiculturalism. And in fact, at the very moment where white multiculturalists would be seeing multiculturalism as a mode of controlling space, there would be lots of Lebanese who would think, it's fantastic multiculturalism. It gives me the space of having my culture, etc. So to me, the two can exist together. And so it's, I've always had a very perspectivist, if you like, notion in this sense. So when you say, do you think multiculturalism, I would imagine you're asking me multiculturalism as government policy. I would imagine you're asking me, do you think that governments should stay committed to multiculturalism? Is it useful? Does it do a good job? Etc. And so from that, I'm very happy to reply that, yes, I think, in fact, when you think about it, when critiques of multiculturalism came from the left, it was always around the fact that multiculturalism did so many good things. And then you have to say, okay, now we have to move on. It's a bit like, actually, I had to rethink that recently when there was this movement, I'll Ride With You, you know. When there was this movement, I'll Ride With You came, I made this statement, and that was very interesting because people immediately said, I'm criticizing people who say, I'll Ride With You. And I said, well, no, I'm not criticizing. I think that's great that people, actually, it's fantastic, especially the early people who did it not out of ritual, was amazingly powerful. But I asked the question, well, okay, do we want to end up in a society where Muslim people need people to write with them in order to exist, you know? So that was a good thing to happen, but that's not where we want to end up. And so if that thing that is good and happened ends up being a structure, that's bad. And in a sense, multiculturalism took us somewhere. But in taking us somewhere, if it ossified, it would have been exactly like this, that, okay, we live in a great society where ethnics are tolerated and everybody is sort of like allowed, and it's really nice, and thank you very much. And so the critics come and say, well, we can push more. Now, of course, the interesting thing is that instead of things being pushed more, we had a politics of regression which has taken away all the gains on which we were trying to build to move multiculturalism more. And so I wouldn't make a statement about multiculturalism. Actually, it relates to what you were talking about in terms of what changed and what have you. So I wouldn't make the same statement today because that I would have made in a political way. I would be more supportive of multiculturalism, probably, but that's a statement about the pitiful state we're in many ways.
Do you know that this is almost an entire rehash of your work, but I'll just directly reference White Nation. You know, the subtitle is Fantasies of White Supremacy in a Multicultural Society. The way I understand this is that, you know, looking out into the audience, Australia is a multicultural society as a lived experience, not as a political concept. And so when white Australians talk about reintroducing a white Australia policy, the fantasy here is that you can actually do it as though, you know, white Australia decided it's time to be a multicultural society, when in reality, Australia just had to accommodate what the country now looked like. So as a lived experience, I already engage in a multicultural society. But as a political concept, it is a term which is
which we really understand as either you're multicultural or you're not. Either you live in a multicultural construct or a white supremacist or white nation or white fantasy construct. But there are degrees and versions of multiculturalism. And the multiculturalism that I experience from day to day is a multiculturalism that says we like this multicultural society insofar as long as, which is why Muslims, Ghassan argues in Multiculturalism and the Ungovernable Muslim, are not seen as necessarily compatible with multicultural policy because in many cases they want to follow the laws of their God as opposed to the laws of man. And so my experience of multiculturalism is a particular type, a celebratory multiculturalism, that we don't mind a multicultural society, as long as it means that we can consume your food, your clothing, aside from the hijab, and your nice dancing and your drums, but that's it.
Yeah, but sorry, that's where for me the problem comes in, because I feel like multiculturalism creates these static identities that we have to sort of fit into. Like Harmony Day in high school, I come from 5 different ethnic backgrounds. And then they were like, so on Harmony Day, what are you going to represent? Are you going to bring food from your Greek background? Are you going to bring, like, your Turkish outfit? Or so it's kind of like, for someone who's extra mixed, you don't know where to fit in within multiculturalism.
Well, I mean, so this invitation, do you feel fixed by it? That's where it comes. Because, you know, I mean, if I'm of Lebanese background and I get a chance to show off my Lebanese culture, why not? But if somebody is fixing me and saying, this is what you are, and it says, I know, oh my God, look, you brought something different from... But at the same time, you might not feel like exhibiting your Lebanese-ness at all at the school, and that's also a problem if a Lebanese must whatever.
Which identity?
Edward Said has this lovely comment at the end of Cultural Imperialism about nobody is ever only one thing. And so the labels that we start with, like Muslim, or he gives the example of Native American, or I can't remember the ones he uses, are only places to start. The problem is when they become the way we frame the entirety of that experience and not acknowledge the journey or whatever of that experience. And I think it's a kind of an interesting kind of point to make. More questions? Yep.
So there's this assumption that there is supposed to be one representative voice for people of colours, and differing voices within communities of colour is supposed to represent the fact that they're divisive, they're unorganised, etc. Whereas different voices coming from white people are celebrated as freedom of speech, democracy, etc. So in that sense, how can we reproduce a narrative for people of colour that facilitates for the multiplicities of voices within communities of people of colour?
Do either of you want to start?
Well, I mean, as an empirical ethnographer, I take it for granted what you're saying, right? I mean, to me, this idea is that that's a political thing, that people who do politics aggregate and etc., but people who do research are always faced with multiplicity. There's no escape in the multiplicity unless you are a particularly bad researcher. And so... What's that?
There are a few of them around.
But so yes, I think your question raises something which is linked to what we started with, which is how often does research succumb to the political? And it's very interesting, you see, because in my experience, sometimes the research that refuses to be political has the best political impact. It is the research that starts with the political and therefore blinkers reality at the service. So the political can be like the political in general, not this side of politics or this side of politics. The political in general can be like a colonizing machine. You know, it starts dominating everything, and suddenly you cannot think outside political categories. And if you start thinking outside, inside political categories, sometimes it's good, but sometimes it actually blunts your analytical capacity. You know, Pierre Bourdieu, who has had a very important influence on me, has always said, good politics does not make good sociology. And good sociology does not make good politics. You cannot take the relation between the two for granted.
Do you know that there's an interview, a very famous interview with a famous African-American writer named Toni Morrison. The interviewer says to her, when are you going to write literature that white people can understand? And her response was, as though our lives mean nothing, that I need to write in order to accommodate a white gaze. And what's really interesting about your question is that when you say, how can we do this, you're only asking it in relation to how can I accommodate a white gaze that sees me this way? And my answer is, don't even worry about it. Don't accommodate it.
Other questions? Yep.
I've got a question, but I just want to start. And this is a true story that at home we call it the PG before Hassan Taj and after Hassan Taj. That's how my life. And in fact, sometimes I'm not joking, as a running joke, if we're arguing, he'll say to me, okay, I'm not Hassan Taj, okay. So you've had a huge impact on my life, and I feel that you've completely changed me. And I've lost some friends along the way and some family, but that's okay. My question is really to try to contextualize what's happening now in the counter-radicalization climate, and to really give an example of how insidious the racism is and the pressure on the Muslim community, and then to ask a question. Am I speaking Latin?
No, yeah, thanks.
So, for example, with the new funding grants now for counter-radicalization that were released 3 days ago by the New South Wales Premier, Islamic schools have been receiving telephone calls from the Premier's office, really encouraging them / pressuring them to take the money to apply so that they can, you know, take advantage of this counter-radicalization framework, institute some programs into their school to try and prevent radicalization. Now, the problem is, you know, twofold. It's the whole narrative of radicalization and that this being a Muslim problem. But one of the problems as an activist is Muslims not understanding that narrative and feeling the double bind and the pressure to accommodate that pressure so that they're not seen as radicals. So with our anti-racism work, I feel that the task is so difficult because on the one hand you need to deal with the white gaze and the white framework and the white nation, but also educate minorities who have internalized that racism and feel they need to appear not scary, that they need to appease this. So how do we do that? Because it's just banging your head against the wall. If 9 out of the schools are refusing the money and 1 takes it, the effort of those 9 to resist that narrative is undermined because that lags still. And I was wondering, in your career in anti-racism, have you seen a change in the way that we are performing anti-racism in the community? Have we moved from that apologist narrative?
Yeah. Although I feel you can tell me more than I can tell you here, Randa, but but I do remember distinctly, very distinctly actually, in Brisbane, but when I don't remember distinctly, about 15 years ago maybe, I was running this line. There was a meeting of Muslim community leaders, with variety of activists and government representatives. And I basically said something like, I know what I said. I talked about when I had this concept, I don't know if I ever published actually in it, I can't remember, but what I called Bilalism. And my idea of Bilalism was that, you know, that Bilal in Muslim sort of in the Quran is the story of when Muhammad relates to the black slave, and the black slave is lifted up in that experience. And I was trying to say that people were saying, oh, you know, the Italians have copped it, the Irish have copped it, and now it's the Muslims that are copying it, you know. And I was saying, no, Islam is different because, you know, indigenous people didn't convert to Italianness in the jail when they were in jail with Italians, but they have converted to Islam because they found something which was transcendent about the experience of Islam, which was not just another ethnicity, etc. So I was running that idea that there was something inherently political that, and so this leader got up and said, I totally reject what you have just said. We, as people, just want to lead normal lives like everybody else, and that's all there is to it. And I said, yes, I agree with you. I'm not saying that you want more than that, but will they let you do that? That is the question. And to me, there's always this thing. So the brick wall, you know, I mean, I don't think in any politics, experience immediately translates into something amazingly clairvoyant or what have you. It is the mediation of people who work with them, and sometimes you're successful and sometimes not. And I don't think, however, it's totally bleaky, is it? I mean, I don't know. You tell me.
Oh, yeah. Islamophobia.
Yeah.
And that changed me to realize you can't construct your identity in anti. You have to think of the alter, and that's really
But I think what's important in some ways is not to allow the forces of normalization and which are some kind of false pacification rule and create a sense that either you are a law-abiding whatever, or you're ISIS. And that, in fact, if you say, look, you know, piss off, you should be able to have that space where, as a Muslim, you can embrace the fact that you represent a radical tradition, if you want to. Obviously, there's people who don't want to. But there must be, we must be able to carve that space to allow it to thrive and not the either or. And that's where the work is.
Did you want to have anything to say?
Well, I think it might be lunchtime.
But did you want to say anything? Because I'm going to wrap up.
No, I think that's a good place to end.
No, well, I'm going to wrap up.
Oh, you're going to wrap up. Yeah, of course.
It's the third time I said it.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. I just want to express a couple of thanks. Firstly, to the Writing Society Research Centre for making this event possible. And secondly, to thank our speakers, Ghassan and Mohammed, for their wonderful insights and stories and jokes and all the other stuff. So please, a round of applause. And now we can eat.